Hope all of you have had some fun over the past few days. Responsibly, of course. Glad to see you this morning. Hope everybody's ready to talk about yeast. I actually went back and looked through the book this morning because I presented on Thursday as well, and I said, I think my title is probably one of the longest, and I checked, and it is, in fact, the longest title out of all the presentations. So we're going to be talking a little bit about selecting yeast based on strain characteristics and applying environmental conditions to alter that. It's an extremely complex topic. I only have 45-ish minutes to talk, so we're not going to cover everything by any means, more of just a general overview. So for those of you who don't know about Fermentis, I just want to quickly introduce who Fermentis is. We're the LaSoft business unit in charge of development, marketing, sales of innovative and quality products and services for and to the beer, wine, spirits, and any other potable alcohol industries worldwide. Some of you may be familiar with our strains. Two most popular are SAF Ale US05 and SAF Ale SO4. But we do carry a wide range of strains as well as our Red Star wine strains. So I know this seems like a very simple question, but I promise it makes sense. What do brewers do? They brew. They clean, they select their ingredients, they mash, they Vorloff, lauter, sparge, boil and hop, sanitize the equipment, they cool the wort, they pitch the yeast, which is what we're talking about today. And then unfortunately you have to clean again. Watch your mouth. All right, so humans alone cannot make beer or alcohol. If we could, we'd get carded any time we went to go buy candy or sugar of some sort. We need the assistance, the help, the beauty of microorganisms in order to make beer or make alcohol. Yeast is a living organism, and we need to respect that because that's, generally speaking, yeast is the only living organism that you want in your beer, unless you're making a sour or something. And it's a living organism, so that's part of what this presentation is about, is the living aspect of it. So what do yeast do? They reproduce and they ferment. They convert sugars, nutrients, amino acids, and other compounds to produce more yeasts, alcohols, plural. And during that process, they release heat, they produce heat, and they release CO2, they produce flavors and aromas, and they produce other compounds. They turn wort into beer by process of fermentation. So what are brewers attempting to do? They're attempting to create an environment for the yeast that will, one, make the yeast happy. Happy yeast makes good beer. And they're also trying to drive characteristics that the brewers want in their beer, and to try not to have the yeast produce unwanted flavors, meaning produce alcohols, produce flavors and aromas, produce other compounds, carbonate the beer, leave a lot of residual sugar or very little, and also to create something that is indistinguishable from somebody else's beer, a clone beer, or just to do something completely unique, your own beer. And all of these can be done by either stressing or not stressing the yeast. So back to the title of the presentation. There's two parts. First part is selecting yeast based on strain characteristics. And the second part is applying environmental conditions to promote the flavor and alcohol production, or flavor and aroma production, sorry. So the selection process. You select yeast based on strain characteristics. Homebrewers have a lot of options. You have dry yeast, Fermentis, and liquid yeast. You have ales or lager yeast. You have American strains or foreign strains. You can use one single strain or you can co-inoculate with multiple strains. There's wild yeast, there's cultured yeast, there's beer yeast, there's wine yeast, there's cider yeast, there's distilling yeast, there's baking yeast. The different species. You can just use yeast, or you can use yeast and bacteria. It all depends on what you're trying to make in the end. So how to select yeast? Primarily, the brewer should select yeast based on a few criteria: the flavor and aroma potential, the attenuation of the strain, the alcohol tolerance, and the flocculation and sedimentation characteristics. But as this presentation suggests, you can alter the environment to change some of the flavors and all of these criteria. And I wanted to just take a second to review what attenuation and flocculation are, because I think they're misunderstood concepts for brewers in general. Attenuation is written as a percentage for the strain, but numerically the number means nothing. Simply put, it's a way for you to compare two or more strains side by side in the same exact wort, the same exact conditions. The brewer selects the ingredients that they're using, which can include simple sugars, and they also perform the mash, which can degrade starches into complex or simple sugars. The attenuation is actually based more on what the brewer does in the process than on the strain, because of the sugars that are in fermentation and the sugar sequence of fermentation. The attenuation comparably between strains is actually the strain's ability to ferment maltotriose, a trisaccharide. So this is the yeast sugar sequence of fermentation for a typical all-grain brew. So you can see the different levels at 0 hours on the left of the various sugars, carbohydrates. Obviously, dextrins are not fermented by yeast, but you can see that in the first 3 days, the simple sugars are fermented out. That's the first energy source for yeast. The fermentation is completed after 6 to 7 days. But this line is the maltotriose fermentation. So you can see that it starts farther on during the fermentation after about 2 days, and then ends up leveling out towards the end of fermentation. This is just a general composition of malt-derived wort. So on the left side, you can see the mash, which will have the solids, the unfermentable sugars and unfermentable extracts, and then the bottom portion is the fermentable extract. And on the right side is composition of wort. Same thing, there's non-fermentable extract and there's fermentable extract. The solid phase is obviously separated during lautering. So why do yeast ferment maltose and maltotriose last or second? It's based on the transport methods. It's much easier for yeast to transport glucose and fructose across the membrane. For the maltose and maltotriose, they have to work harder, and then they have to break down those disaccharides and trisaccharides into glucose to enter into the metabolism pathway. And during all of this, they're producing aldehydes, sulfur compounds, fusel alcohols, esters, organic acids, and a number of other flavors and compounds. So this chart, it's just with USO5 and different malt compositions, or different wort compositions. And you can see that down at the bottom, there's initial monosaccharides, so those are the simple sugars, and then sucrose is the third one down. But you can see that the maltotriose conversion, which is at the top, the percent of utilization is very dependent on the profile, or the wort profile, and the degree Plato. Flocculation is another misunderstood concept. Yeast flocculation is actually the cells coming together and bonding. It's not the sedimentation characteristics. So sedimentation is usually what brewers are talking about when they say flocculation. So the yeast settling out of solution. It's impossible to tell if your yeast is flocculating or not unless you're microscope analyzing it. So again, I got sidetracked. Back to the yeast selection based on characteristics. So each strain has its own unique flavor and aroma profile, as well as attenuation, the maltitrous conversion capacity, and the alcohol tolerance. The flavors and aromas are generally relative to the type of beers that the yeast was selected for over time. Beer as we know it today has been made and recorded for over 5,000 years, and we've only known about yeast since the late 1860s. The attenuation and alcohol tolerance were also selected over time. Ales generally produce more yeast flavor and aroma, while lagers will produce more sulfur compounds. So generally, the characteristics of different strains, these are just a view on most ale strains. American ales are strong ester, slight citrus, aroma, and flavor. Usually have moderate attenuation and very slight sulfur. English ales have slight to moderate ester, low attenuation, and very slight sulfur. Belgian ales, slightly strong, or slight to strong ester, slight to strong phenol, possibly spicy characteristics, high attenuation, and slight sulfur. And then European ales outside of England and Belgium, slight ester, moderate to high attenuation, possible phenolic like a Hefeweizen strain, and slight sulfur. Lagers in general produce a lower yeast-derived flavor, but generally by region, German lagers are crisp, clean, balanced, slight to moderate ester, slight sulfur. Eastern European strains, Eastern European lagers are clean, slight ester, moderate sulfur, and Northern European strains, clean, moderate ester, and slight sulfur. So the Eastern versus Northern European, they're flip-flopped for sulfur and ester production. So when selecting a yeast strain, it's most important to understand the possibilities of flavor production, the aromatics, precursor production, alcohol tolerance, and attenuation. Even when a supplier such as Fermentis says that the strain is neutral, the brewer can alter the environment, the process, to influence the strain to produce more flavors and flavor precursors, and the opposite is true as well. If a supplier says that the strain is really estery, you can change the environment so that it's not producing as much ester. Also, some of the human recognized flavors is interactions of different molecules over time, not just strictly produced by the yeast. The molecules that are changing over time are produced by the yeast, but the flavor itself isn't. So I just put up an example. If you've ever had a young barley wine, usually it's hot, it's really alcoholic, it's unbalanced, it has a really short palate, but when it's aged over time, the fusel alcohols will actually interact with different compounds, producing a smooth, balanced, and a lengthy palate. And this just shows based on most of our strains, it's not including the Saftbrew Abbey, but you can see the differences by strain in the same exact situation, the different ethyl acetate production, the different isoamyl acetate production, and then the total higher alcohol production, propanol, isobutanol, isoamyl alcohol. And this is where the brewer, when they're selecting the yeast strain, this is what you have available to look at to say, oh, I want a higher isoamyl acetate, so you'd select more from between SO4, T58, because this is what the producers are saying the strains will produce. It's not the complete picture, though. This is one or a few experiments that build this data. So strain selection is similar to selecting ingredient. The brewer bases this decision on the possibility of flavors and aromas that can be produced by the strain. The brewer then dictates the amount, the addition time, and how he or she will use the strain to promote flavor impact. Similar to other ingredients, and like I said before, brewers can use more than one strain, a co-inoculation, to either drive flavors from the different strains or to complete fermentation of maltotriose if the flavor from the first strain is what you're looking for, but you want a dry beer in the end. So strain selection is just the starting point. That's, you're basing that on what the producers, what the companies that are supplying the yeast are telling you the possible flavor impact is. So part two, applying environmental conditions to promote flavor and aroma production. And this is where it gets really complex, and there's no way that I could even scratch the surface because there is so much that goes into play for flavor and aroma based on the environmental conditions. So what are the flavors in beer? Beer has flavor from the malts that you use, the base malts, the pale malts, the caramel malts, the kiln, the roasted, rye, wheat, the list goes on and on. There's hundreds of different malts, so you're getting flavors from the malts. There's hop flavors. If you're using American hops or noble hops or experimental hops, or you're adding hops to your mash, or you're dry hopping, or you're early kettle hopping or late kettle hopping, all of those will promote different flavors coming from the hops. There's water flavors. If you have hard water at home and you're using that, there's a lot of minerals. There's some flavors that will come through with the water. Obviously, water is a majority of what beer is, usually 90 to 95%. If you're using soft water, the opposite is true. There aren't the minerals there. You can add brewing salts to your water to add minerals. And then you also get flavors from adjuncts. If you're adding fruit to your beer, if you're adding vegetables, if you're adding spices or different sugars, sucrose or Belgian candy sugar, you're getting flavors from those. And then the last is yeast flavors, which is what we're talking about today. So because you have so many different flavors and aromas in the beer, it's very difficult to talk completely about the yeast flavor because it's dependent on all the other things. So what are the environmental conditions that the brewer can alter? You have your choice of ingredients. You have your mash profile. You have fermentation temperatures, pitch rates, original gravity, the strain or strains that you're choosing, and the fermenter shape and design. So in general, it's not a complete list of yeast flavors by any means, but this is what we'll mostly be talking about today: the esters, phenols, acids, alcohols, residual sugar, which isn't a yeast flavor, but it's yeast dependent, cider notes, lysing of cells, which produces sulfurs, meaty notes, aldehydes, diacetyls, soapy notes. So esters. It's a bonding between an alcohol and a carboxylic acid, generally produced more at higher temperatures. Generally, more is produced at lower aeration. Acetyl-CoA can actually be in excess in yeast in low oxygen environments. Generally, more is produced with low pitch rates. More cell growth will produce more esters. Generally, less is produced with increased fermentation pressure, which generally isn't an issue for home brewers because you usually have an airlock or something that's releasing the pressure. But if you were to ferment in a sealed container, the increased pressure on the fermentation would lower the production of esters. Generally, more esters are produced in tall, thin fermenters in fermenter design and less in shallow, wide-based fermenters. And all the esters, all the different flavor characteristics have different thresholds. So, for example, isoamyl acetate, the human threshold is about 1.4 ppm. Ethyl acetate, the human threshold is about 33 ppm. Ethyl acetate is actually the most common and highest concentration ester that's in beer because most of the alcohol that the yeast produces is ethanol. So there's phenols. 4-VG is the most common. The precursor is ferulic acid. Some strains have a POF positive phenotype, and that's phenolic off-flavor positive phenotype, which sounds negative, but obviously in some beers, phenolics are wanted, they're desired. It increases with the larger malt bill percentage of ingredients that have high ferulic acid content, such as wheat. That's why Hefeweizen usually has some phenolic compounds to it. And it increases with the ferulic acid rest, 109 degrees Fahrenheit to 113, in your mash profile. Alcohols, the most important alcohols that are common in beer, ethanol, of course, Usually beer will have some ethanol to it, and that's usually why some of us decide to drink the beverage. In addition to it being a lovely, flavorful, and aromatic product, propanol, isobutanol, isomyl alcohol. So these alcohols are what will bond with the carboxylic acids to produce esters. Generally, the higher alcohols are produced due to stress on the yeast, and those stresses are high original gravity, unbalanced sugar composition, meaning more simple sugars, high fermentation temperatures, and pitch rate. If you under pitch or over pitch, you'll develop different alcohols. And like I said, it's the precursor for esters and flavor, other flavors and aromas. So residual sugars, often referred to as RE, residual extract. It's primarily dependent on the strain. Again, our friend attenuation. Also strongly dependent on the ingredients used. So if you're adding more simple sugars to your malt bill, the percentage of sugar still in your beer will be lower in comparison when you're using just all malt. And that's due to the RDF, the real degree of fermentation. Too much simple sugar can lead to a glycophilic stall in fermentation, so stuck fermentation, leading to a higher RE. Generally, that I've seen that more commonly done in saisons, where you're trying to get a really dry beer, so you're adding more simple sugars to your wort. And these will actually just go into glucose fermentation and will ignore the other sugar compounds. And then the off flavors that are produced by yeast. Cidery notes, usually a lack of yeast nutrition. Increased amounts of simple sugars will do this as well. Excess sulfur. Typically, there will be sulfur in German beers and lager beers, but increased excess sulfur is usually due to cells lysing. Meaty notes can be from partially or fully autolyzed yeast. Aldehydes are produced naturally during fermentation as an intermediate compound and later absorbed by the yeast. So they should disappear over time, but obviously they don't always. Diacetyl or vicinal diketones, again, produced naturally during fermentation, during the growth phase, and it's due to lack of valine and isoleucine, and thus the yeast have to synthesize those themselves. And then soapy notes are generally fatty acids degrading, and that comes from dead or inactive yeast. So to summarize, yeast is a living organism. Respect that. Brewers have the ability to select strains based on simple but dynamic criteria. You can change the environment to alter those flavors and aromas. There are many aspects that the brewer's in control of, the original gravity, the temperature, the ingredients, the fermenter design, the mashing, the pitch rate of the yeast. Yeast produce far too many compounds to talk about in one presentation. And you're trying to create the best environment for the yeast to thrive and to produce the flavors that you want. So now what? Suppliers like Fermentis, they'll tell you generally what the flavors are that are produced, but experiment. You can find the best yeast or yeasts or microorganisms for your fermentation in your beer. Have fun. I think that's why I started brewing beer at home initially, and also because I found out how to do it when I was 20 years old, so I could do that. I could go to the store and buy all the ingredients, go home, make beer, and nobody had to know about it. Don't be afraid to try something different or use a strain for something that isn't suggested for. And for this, when I was talking on Thursday, I said, think about Belgian IPA. Because a few years ago, that wasn't a classification of beer. It wasn't a style of beer. But because brewers started using Belgian yeast in IPAs, they developed the Belgian IPA. Or a white IPA. And I know I'm focusing on IPAs. There's just 30 different styles now of IPAs. But it's really, have fun with it, change, do things that aren't just standard style right beers. I like the style guidelines. I think it's a good place to start, but I always say that if you're making good beer, it doesn't matter what style it is or what classification it fits under. If it's good beer, it's good beer. And you are in control of the beer and production. Do it your way and only your way. So now, time for questions. The floor is yours. There's a mic in the middle. If you'd like to come up, ask questions, please feel free. I'll try to answer any questions you have.
In your yeast packets,
yeah.
If I get a fresh yeast packet, what is the cell count? And as a follow-up, if I store that in my refrigerator for a year, what could I expect the yeast cell count to be of that packet?
It's a very good question. Actually, for Mentis, we don't base the pitch rate on cell count. We base it on biomass. So that's why the weight of the packet is always 11.5 grams. So the reason being is that each strain is a different size cell. So some of our strains are larger cells, some of our strains are smaller cells. So to create a consistent product, we do by weight, which will give you enough biomass for a fermentation for a 5 gallon. So it's not based on cell count. I could tell you roughly what the cell count is.
That'd be great. Thank
but
you.
I looked it up recently. I figured it out because if you take the pitch rate with 11.5 grams per 5 gallons, and if you look at our spec sheets, it says that with that, you'll end up with roughly 6 million cells per milliliter. So,
all right, just do the math from there.
Yeah.
What about, like I said, a year later, what can I expect in terms of...
A year later, okay. So with our yeast, it's extremely shelf stable. Currently, we're at a 2-year shelf life. So 2 years from the date of production. We're actually moving to a 3-year shelf life now because we've done extensive studies on the viability over the years. If you refrigerate, like you're saying, annually you'll lose about 5% viability.
That's 5% per year?
5% per year.
Okay.
If you keep it at room temperature, you'll lose about 10% viability per year.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was really intrigued by what you just said about biomass. And I know when I'm doing my brewing, I'm always obsessing about, you know, hitting the right cell count. I mean, are we misplaced in worrying about cell count? Should we be more focused on biomass? And as a follow-up to that is, how much variation is there in, say, yeast cell size between different strains? So, you know, is one strain like for 100 million cells, you know, twice the biomass of another strain?
So the reason that we base our pitch rate on biomass is because it's in dry format. Mm-hmm. And you can weigh dry format. If you had a liquid culture, you can't weigh the biomass of that liquid culture. But cell count is definitely still important if you were to repitch. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you don't know what quantity of yeast you have. So then cell count becomes extremely important. The difference in cell size, it's not a huge difference. Mm-hmm. But we do have some strains for distilling that are like a third of the size of standard yeast cells. And it's just, each strain is unique. Each strain is different in that aspect.
Cool. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, I was intrigued in one of your slides. Could you potentially cut down the diacetyl by tossing some valine and some isoleucine into the fermenter?
I got this question on Thursday. It's a very good question. And I think that kind of makes the light bulb turn on your head when you see that. The reason that brewers in general don't try to supplement those two amino acids is because the yeast naturally produce VDK, but then they also naturally reabsorb and convert it later in the fermentation. So you're not necessarily concerned about the production. Typically, a VDK rest at the end of fermentation will only be 2 days, so it's not...
I'm not going to gain you anything.
I mean, you can change it by adding some yeast nutrients. Some yeast nutrients will actually have that. My company, for the wine industry, we produced yeast derivatives, So we propagate yeast solely to kill them and then take parts of them. And in that way, you could potentially isolate those amino acids.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great presentation.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question about... I struggle with both home brewers and professional brewers sometimes talking about chloramine removal and making sure there's no chloramine in your water. And I've had pro brewers say, well, we just over-pitch. The concern I would have is autolysis and degradation. Have you seen anything in, you know, in y'all's environment in regards to why you really want to get those chloramines out of there as far as you mentioned things such as the vinyl guanacol, the VG, as well as the sulfur and soapy characteristics?
Yeah. I'm sorry. What is the question?
The question is, have y'all seen, like, you talk about how you control the environment for the yeast. Having water that has a chloramine residual within it? Any impact on yeast health?
I'm not sure about that. The hard thing is, so, with yeast, with it being a living organism, with it being so dynamic, it's very difficult for even a yeast provider to study all the different things, and I don't know if we have any information on that or not.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
The chlorine would probably be gone by the time yeast were there, because if you went through your match process,
yeah,
you reacted out with all the sugars, and you can have chlorinated sugars.
Yeah.
Chlorine will, but chloramine will not. Chloramine is a persistent stable ion. If chlorine will boil out, but if you are in a surface water system that chloraminates, yeah, it's still going to be there. It will not boil out.
Yeah, the end of the brew day, we're all kind of tired and lazy, and I almost never put the dry yeast in, like, a starter or proof it.
Yeah.
And so I've never had any problems with the beer. I the SO4, I love it. I use it all the time. And you know, other home brewers are looking at me like, why aren't you starting that with a, you know, a starter first or proofing it? Any thoughts on that? Is it affecting the beer?
Yeah. So we don't recommend starters because it's another place for you to potentially get an infection. Generally with liquid, you do perform starters because the liquid yeast isn't as stable as the dry format, so you need to build up the cell mass before you pitch. And with our yeast, we kind of changed our mind about a year and a half ago. We don't even recommend rehydrating anymore because it's not necessary. The yeast will rehydrate in the wort if you just dry pitch on top. And the reason being is if you follow the strict guidelines of the past where you have to put the yeast into water that's 85 degrees Fahrenheit and then let that sit for 20 minutes and then stir it and then let it sit again for 30 minutes. The protocol is different for a lot of different dry yeast manufacturers. But when you're doing that, you're putting the yeast into a zero sugar concentration. And then when you pitch the yeast, you're putting it from zero sugar to whatever your starting gravity is. So you can have sugar shock to the yeast. Also, if your wort temperature that you're pitching into is outside of 10 degrees Fahrenheit difference from your rehydration water, you'll have temperature shock, which will significantly decrease your viability. So as a company, we're now saying, you can still rehydrate. You can rehydrate in water. You can rehydrate in wort. But for ease of application, for keeping infection possibilities as low as you can also just dry pitch on top. And that's what I do at home. I mean, I never rehydrate my yeast.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you had an opinion on the idea of adding sugar later. You know, so if you have a yeast that's a little finicky, like a, you know, one of the Saison yeasts, and you know, the idea is you make it work harder on the the maltose and then add the sugar like after 3 days. I mean, that's what I have done, and it has worked in that it has worked, but I haven't not done it to see if it would work. If I didn't,
You can definitely do it and have success with it. But again, if you're adding sugar part of the way into the fermentation, you're also adding the potential of having another infection. Because if you add it pre-boil, you're boiling everything, and you should be fairly sterile at that point or fairly sanitary. You can add sugars later. You can actually drive most yeast strains upwards of 16, maybe 18% if you dose sugar. But it's very difficult to have a controlled system to do that. So,
question on making high gravity beers and having a lot of fusel alcohols or alcoholic heat afterwards. Is there recommended conditions for fermentation that would help minimize that so you get a higher faster aging on the high gravity?
Yeah. So there's a few things you can do. Increase your pitch rate, because a lot of those fusel alcohols are produced due to stress on the yeast having to reproduce to eventually ferment the sugars. And also, if you ferment at a slightly lower temperature than you usually would, you'll never get rid of the fusel alcohol production, but you can minimize it with different environmental conditions.
So just asking about yeast selection, I think Fermentis has somewhere around a dozen beer yeasts, and the W companies have probably four dozen apiece. I wonder, what's behind that? Why is it simpler to select a Fermentis yeast versus Y yeast or White Labs?
Why is it?
It's simpler because there's fewer choices. Right?
Yeah.
If I want to do an American ale, there's one yeast. I use that one.
Okay, so the reason why we only supply, currently we have 8 strains for home brewers. Fermentis changed its focus a year and a half ago. So now we're just potable alcohol. We used to include bioethanol and biorenewable fermentations. The reason that we only have the limited number currently is because each of the strains that we produce, we go through a different propagation process and then also a different drying process. So each strain has its own unique. Some are more finicky than others. Obviously, if you're propagating lagers versus ales, there's a difference there. But each of our strains is produced in a slightly different propagation and then also drying method.
Morning.
Good morning.
Question about the rehydration direct pitch for you. I recently started doing the rehydration and a little bit of a gentle stir for a half hour, and then putting it straight in to a cooled wort at about 65 degrees. I was doing that primarily because I had heard that at the higher temperatures, like an 80 degree pitch, and we might get some more of those fusel alcohols that can be produced during the growth or lag phase. So I'm wondering how you talked about direct pitch, dry on top of there. Would we still need to do that at 80 and then eventually let it cool down? Or are we good to pitch at 65 on just the wort?
Yeah, you can pitch at 65. It won't rehydrate as quickly. So that's another difference between rehydrating and just dry pitching. When you rehydrate, obviously you're rehydrating the yeast in a separate container, and then when you pitch, the yeast is already in liquid solution, so it will start fermentation right away. When you dry pitch on top, usually, generally speaking, you'll lose about 4-6% viability from the tests that we've done, the fermentation will take an extra hour to 2 hours. But when you're talking about a 7-14 day fermentation, an hour or two, it really isn't a big deal. So with the cooler you go on rehydrating, it'll be a slower activation of the yeast. So you can do it. I've done it every time that I've homebrewed since I started with Fermentis. and I've had great success with it.
So that 4 to 6% you're saying about the viability getting reduced, I believe that probably based on your biomass, it's still plenty enough I wouldn't be under pitching.
Well, and when you look at it, our best before date, which is our, it's not an expiration, but it's best to use our yeast currently within 2 years. Even if you keep the yeast refrigerated for the 2 years, you're losing 5% viability annually. So at the end of 2 years, you're 10% less viable. And if you keep it at room temperature, 10% viability annually, you're at 80% of viability at the end of 2 years. And that still is plenty of yeast for fermentation.
Just real quick comment too, not so much related to the yeast question, but the expiration date. I recently found a pack of old yeast in my garage. I move around a lot, and my kids wanted to use it for making root beer, and the expiration was July of 2015. I put it in, and it fermented that root beer, decarbonated up in a matter of 3 days. So yeah, it still worked awesome.
I've had people write into the website telling us that they had yeast that was 7 years past the BBE, and they used it, and it was still plenty for the fermentation. It's obviously not going to be as healthy of a fermentation because you do lose viability over time, but you can still use it if you want.
Thank you.
Well, I'm a little late today, but it was a long night. I didn't catch the whole thing here, but I 43 years ago when I started doing this kind of thing, it was wine, not beer, but I did use a starter, but you never use water. You use warm sugar, simplex sugars with water, or most of the time I use orange juice warm to get my starter going because I want a roaring starting primary. And then, but I got some questions about your products. I was thinking about using conical or more vertical type of fermenter.
Yeah.
What is what's the story on that? Do you have certain yeasts that are better for higher alcohol content? That's what you're maybe trying to get at, or how's that go?
No, the fermenter design isn't anything due to alcohol. I mean, it does come into play if you're trying to produce a really high alcohol beer.
Well, I don't want real alcohol. High, but above 9%, let's say.
That's pretty high.
Oh, okay.
shallow, wide tanks, you'll actually have a lower degree of fermentation, so you won't produce as much alcohol from the sugars. The taller, thin you will get a more complete fermentation.
Can you use multiples, you know, layer it so some of your yeast might not do all the material that you're trying to ferment. Others will pick up the rest.
Yeah, so that's the co-inoculation that you might not have been in here for that. But
okay,
you can take one strain and do primary fermentation and then take a second strain to complete the fermentation. It's just in that scenario you need to acclimate the second strain to the alcohol that's in the beer. Or right. Wine or whatever.
It might kill it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's another shock that can happen to yeast if you pitch a different strain into high alcohol solution.
Because I'm just trying to make it create as much zymize and other enzymes that I'm looking for. Is that right? Some of your yeast produces more zymize than others?
Each strain has different enzyme characteristics. And that's part of what comes into play when you're talking attenuation. It's not the complete picture. Part of it's also the transportation of the sugars across the membrane.
Right.
But the different strains have different enzyme composition or productivity.
So do your yeast work with wine as well as with other types of products?
It's a good question. So brewing strains, they will ferment simple sugars, maltose, maltotriose.
Right.
So the simple sugars part, that's wine. Wine is all simple sugar.
Yes.
Same with mead. Honey is all simple sugar. So you can use brewing strains for wine or mead production. The flavors that you'll get from those, though, I'm not sure you would want in wine. I don't think we've done any studies on that, but we have wine strains as well. The Red Star, small Red Star, 5-gram sachets are fermentous product as well.
Yeah, because my grandfather and great-grandfather used to brew their beer in the basement in St. Louis, and they used to use Fleischmann's, and it gives a bready taste to your beer, but
yeah.
I wasn't the brewmaster.
Along the line of mead and wine, for the no rehydration rule, when you're rehydrating for mead, you're also using something like a Gopher and Protect or something, right, to prepare it for an environment that's...
Well, I wouldn't personally use GoFirm, but...
You're right, something like that. But does the no rehydration rule still apply for those kind of environments as well?
Yeah. I mean, whenever you're talking about wine or mead, the sugar sources for those, honey and grapes, they have extremely low nutrition for yeast. So if you're really trying to make a good wine or a good mead, you need to supplement nutrition one way or another, whether you use a competitor of mine's product. You can use GoFirm if you want. So you need to supplement. The rehydration for that, it's the same. Whether you rehydrate or you don't, that's up to you. But you will need to add nutrient at some point because the grapes and the honey just don't have very much for the yeast to grow on.
Right, but adding nutrients...
Adding nutrient to the rehydration?
Yeah, that doesn't really matter.
It can. I mean, in an environment that's nutrient deficient, it's much harder for the yeast cells to grow because they don't have the building blocks to grow new yeast, to bud, and to separate. But whether you add it to your rehydration or to your fermenter, the yeast is getting the nutrient one way or another. And if you're rehydrating, generally it's an hour or less time that it's rehydrating. So I guess in that way you don't need to add the nutrient to your water, your rehydration, but you do need it in the fermentation.
Yeah, in the mushroom. Okay.
Anyone else? Let's hear it for Kevin. Thank you so much for doing this presentation again.